The taxi waiting at the head of the line was a replica of the one they'd used at Dallas-Fort Worth. A clean Caprice with the air roaring full blast and the driver's compartment decorated halfway between a religious shrine and a living room. They disappointed the guy by asking him for the shortest ride available on Oahu, which was the half-mile hop around the perimeter road to the Hickam Air Force Base entrance. The guy glanced backward at the line of cars behind him, and Reacher saw him thinking about the better fares the other drivers would get. $10 tip in it for you, he said. The guy gave him the same look the ticket clerk at Dallas-Fort Worth had used. A fare that was going to leave the meter stuck on the basic minimum, but a $10 tip? Reacher saw a photograph of what he guessed was the guy's family, taped to the vinyl of the dash. A big family. Dark, smiling children, and a dark, smiling woman in a cheerful print dress, all standing in front of a clean, simple home with something vigorous growing in a dirt patch to the right. He thought about the Hobies, alone in the dark silence up in Brighton, with the hiss of the oxygen bottle and the squeak of the worn wooden floors, and Rudder in the dusty squalor of his Bronx storefront. $20, he said, if we get going right now, okay?
$20?
The guy repeated, amazed. $30. For your kids. They look nice. The guy grinned in the mirror and touched his fingers to his lips and laid them gently on the shiny surface of the photograph. He swung the cab through the lane changes onto the perimeter track and came off again more or less immediately, 800 yards into the journey, outside a military gate which looked identical to the one fronting Fort Walters. Shody opened the door and stepped out into the heat, and Reacher went into his pocket and came out with his roll of cash. Top bill was a 50, and he peeled it off and pushed it through the little hinged door in the plexiglass. Keep it. Then he pointed at the photograph. That your house? The driver nodded. Is it holding up okay? Anything need fixing on it? The guy shook his head.
Tip-top condition.
The roof okay?
No problems at all.
Reacher nodded. Just checking. He slid across the vinyl and joined Jody on the blacktop. The taxi moved off through the haze, back towards the civilian terminal. There was a faint breeze coming off the ocean, salt in the air. Jody pushed the hair off her face and looked around. Where are we going? Silhi, Reacher said. It's right inside here. He pronounced it phonetically, and it made her smile.
Silly,
she repeated. So what's that? C-I-L-H-I, he said. Central Identification Laboratory, Hawaii. It's the Department of the Army's main facility.
For what?
I'll show you for what, he said. Then he paused. At least I hope I will. They walked up to the gatehouse and waited at the window. There was a sergeant inside, same uniform, same haircut, same suspicious expression on his face as the guy at Walters. He made them wait in the heat for a second, and then he slid the window back. Reacher stepped forward and gave their names. We're here to see Nash Newman, he said. The sergeant looked surprised and picked up a clipboard and peeled thin sheets of paper back. He slid a thick finger along a line and nodded, picked up a phone and dialed a number. 4 digits, an internal call. He announced the visitors and listened to the reply, and then he looked puzzled. He covered the phone with his palm and turned back to Jody.
How old are you, miss?
He asked.
30,
Jody said, puzzled in turn. 30, the MP repeated into the phone. Then he listened again and hung it up and wrote something on the clipboard, turned back to the window.
He'll be right out, so come on through.
They squeezed through the narrow gap between the gatehouse wall and the heavy counterweight on the end of the vehicle barrier and waited on the hot pavement 6 feet away from where they had started, but now it was military pavement, not Hawaii Department of Transportation pavement, and that made a lot of difference to the look on the sergeant's face. The suspicion was all gone, replaced by frank curiosity about why the legendary Nash Newman was in such a big hurry to get these two civilians inside the base. There was a low concrete building maybe 60 yards away with a plain personnel door set in the blank end wall. The door opened up and a silver-haired man stepped out.
He turned back to close it and lock it, and then set out at a fast walk towards the gatehouse. He was in the pants and the shirt of an army tropical issue uniform, with a white lab coat flapping open over them. There was enough metal punched through the collar of the shirt to indicate he was a high-ranking officer, and nothing in his distinguished bearing to contradict that impression. Reacher moved to meet him, and Jody followed. The silver-haired guy was maybe 55, and up close he was tall, with a handsome patrician face and a natural athletic grace in his body that was just beginning to yield to the stiffness of age. "General Newman," Reacher said, "this is Jody Garber." Newman glanced at Reacher and took Jody's hand, smiling.
"Pleased to meet you, General," she said.
"We already met," Newman said.
"We did?"
she said, surprised. "You wouldn't recall it," he said. "At least, I'd be terribly surprised if you did. You were 3 years old at the time, I guess. In the Philippines. It was in your father's backyard. I remember you brought me a glass of Planter's Punch. It was a big glass and a big yard, and you were a very little girl. You carried it in both hands, with your tongue sticking out, concentrating. I watched you all the way, with my heart in my mouth in case you dropped it." She smiled.
"Well, you're right. I'm afraid I don't recall it. I was 3.
"That's an awful long time ago now." Newman nodded. "That's why I checked how old you looked. I didn't mean for the sergeant to come right out and ask you straight. I wanted his subjective impression, is all. It's not the sort of thing one should ask a lady, is it? But I was wondering if you could really be Leon's daughter, come to visit me." He squeezed her hand and let it go, turned to Reacher and punched him lightly on the shoulder. "Jack Reacher," he said. "Damn, it's good to see you again." Reacher caught Newman's hand and shook it hard, sharing the pleasure. "General Newman was my teacher," he said to Jody. "He did a spell at Staff College about 1 million years ago. Advanced forensics. Taught me everything I know." "He was a pretty good student," Newman said to her. "Paid attention, at least, which is more than most of them did."
"So what is it you do, General?" she asked.
"Well, I do a little forensic anthropology," Newman said. "He's the best in the world," Reacher said. Newman waved away the compliment. "Well, I don't know about that."
"Anthropology," Jody said. "But isn't that studying remote tribes and things? How they live, their rituals and beliefs and so on?"
"No, that's cultural anthropology," Newman said. "There are many different disciplines. Mine is forensic anthropology, which is a part of physical anthropology." "Studying human remains for clues," Reacher said.
"A bone doctor," Newman said. "That's about what it amounts to."
They were drifting down the sidewalk as they talked, getting nearer the plain door in the blank wall. It opened up, and a younger man was standing there waiting for them in the entrance corridor. A nondescript guy, maybe 30 years old, in a lieutenant's uniform under a white lab coat. Newman nodded towards him. "This is Lieutenant Simon. He runs the lab for me. Couldn't manage without him." He introduced Reacher and Jody, and they shook hands all around. Simon was quiet and reserved. Reacher figured him for a typical lab guy, annoyed at the disruption to the measured routine of his work. Newman led them inside and down the corridor to his office, and Simon nodded silently to him and disappeared.
"Sit down," Newman said. "Let's talk."
"So you're a sort of pathologist?" Jody asked him.
Newman took his place behind his desk and rocked his hand from side to side, indicating a disparity.
"Well, a pathologist has a medical degree, and we anthropologists don't. We studied anthropology, pure and simple. The physical structure of the human body. That's our field. We both work post-mortem, of course, but generally speaking, if a corpse is relatively fresh, it's a pathologist's job, and if there's only a skeleton left, then it's our job. So, I'm a bone doctor."
Jody nodded.
"Of course, that's a slight simplification," Newman said. "A fresh corpse can raise questions concerning its bones. Suppose there's a dismemberment involved. The pathologist would refer to us for help. We can look at the saw marks on the bones and help out.
We can say how weak or strong the perpetrator was, what kind of saw he used, was he left-handed or right-handed, things like that. But 99 times out of 100, I'm working on skeletons, dry old bones. Then he smiled again, a private, amused smile. And pathologists are useless with dry old bones. Really, really hopeless. They don't know the first thing about them. Sometimes I wonder what the hell they teach them in medical school. The office was quiet and cool. No windows. Indirect lighting from concealed fixtures. Carpet on the floor. A rosewood desk. Comfortable leather chairs for the visitors. And an elegant clock on a low shelf, ticking quietly, already showing 3:30 in the afternoon. Just 3.5 hours until the return flight. "We're here for a reason, General," Reacher said. "This isn't entirely a social call, I'm afraid." "Social enough to stop calling me General and start calling me Nash, okay? And tell me what's on your mind." Reacher nodded. "We need your help, Nash." Newman looked up. "With the MIA list?" Then he turned to Jody to explain. "That's what I do here," he said. 20 years. I've done nothing else." She nodded. "It's about a particular case. We sort of got involved in it." Newman nodded back slowly, but this time the light was gone from his eyes. "Yes, I was afraid of that," he said. "There are 89,120 MIA cases here, but I bet I know which one you're interested in."
89,000? Jody repeated, surprised.
"And 120. 2,200 missing from Vietnam. 8,170 missing from Korea, and 78,750 missing from World War II. We haven't given up on any single one of them, and I promise you we never will."
"God, why so many?"
Newman shrugged, a bitter sadness suddenly there in his face. "Wars," he said. "High explosive, tactical movement, airplanes. Wars are fought. Some combatants live, some die. Some of the dead are recovered, some of them aren't. Sometimes there's nothing left to recover. A direct hit on a man by an artillery shell will reduce him to his constituent molecules. He's just not there anymore. Maybe a fine red mist drifting through the air, maybe not even that. Maybe he's completely boiled off to vapor. A near miss will blow him to pieces. And fighting is about territory, isn't it? So, even if the pieces of him are relatively large, enemy tank movement or friendly tank movement back and forth across the disputed territory will plow the pieces of him into the earth, and then he's gone forever." He sat in silence, and the clock ticked slowly around. "And airplanes are worse. Many of our air campaigns have been fought over oceans. A plane goes down in the ocean and the crew is missing until the end of time, no matter how much effort we expend in a place like this." He waved his hand in a vague gesture that took in the office and all the unseen space beyond and ended up resting towards Jody, palm up like a mute appeal.
89,000, she said.
"I thought the MIA stuff was just about Vietnam, 2,000 or so."
89,120, Newman said again.
"We still get a few from Korea, the occasional one from World War II, the Japanese islands. But you're right. This is mostly about Vietnam. 2,200 missing. Not so very many, really. They lost more than that in a single morning during World War I, every morning for 4 long years. Men and boys blown apart and mashed into the mud. But Vietnam was different, partly because of things like World War I. We won't take that wholesale slaughter anymore, and quite rightly, we've moved on. The population just won't stand for those old attitudes now."
Jody nodded quietly.
"And partly because we lost the war in Vietnam," Newman said quietly. "That makes it very different. The only war we ever lost. Makes it all feel a hell of a lot worse. So, we try harder to resolve things."
He made the gesture with his hand again, indicating the unseen complex beyond the office door, and his voice ended on a brighter note.
"So,
That's what you do here? Jody asked. Wait for skeletons to be discovered overseas, and then bring them back here to identify, so you can finally tick the names off the missing lists. Newman rocked his hand again, equivocating.
Well, we don't wait, exactly. Where we can, we go out searching for them. And we don't always identify them, although we sure as hell try hard.
It must be difficult, she said. He nodded.
Technically, it can be very challenging. The recovery sites are usually a mess. The field workers send us animal bones, local bones, anything. We sort it all out here. Then we go to work with what we've got, which sometimes isn't very much. Sometimes all that's left of an American soldier is just a handful of bone fragments you could fit in a cigar box.
Impossible, she said.
Often, he said back. We've got 100 part skeletons here right now, unidentified. The Department of the Army can't afford mistakes. They demand a very high standard of certainty, and sometimes we just can't meet it.
Where do you start? She asked.
Well, wherever we can. Medical records, usually. Suppose Reacher here was an MIA. If he'd broken his arm as a boy, we'd be able to match the old X-ray against a healed break in the bones we found. Maybe. Or if we found his jaw, we could match the work on his teeth with his dental charts. Reacher saw her looking at him, imagining him reduced to dry, yellowing bones on a jungle floor, scraped out of the dirt and compared to brittle, fading X-rays taken 30 years earlier. The office went silent again, and the clock ticked around.